Hey, I know what'll cheer you up.
Welcome to the Bright Ideas Podcast, where we let proven experts help you to find the next bright idea to implement in your business today. And now, here's your host, Trent Deersmith.
This is unbelievable.
This true force has never been fully understood.
Hey there, Bright Idea Hunters. Welcome to the Bright Ideas Podcast. I am your host, Trent Deersmith. And this is the podcast for business owners and marketers who want to better learn how to use online marketing and sales automation tactics to massively boost their business. And the way that we do that is we bring experts onto the show to share their experience, their ideas, and their thoughts with you. And today we're going to be doing that again. And my guest is Paul, and I should have asked you how to pronounce your last name, but I'm going to take a stab at it. Roetzer?
No worries. Yeah, it's close enough. It's Roetzer, but Roetzer is the most common pronunciation I hear, right. So we'll go with it.
All right. So Paul is the founder of a firm called PR 2020, and he's also the founder of something called the Marketing Agency Blueprint. So if you run a marketing agency, this is an interview that you absolutely want to stay glued to. So Paul, thank you very much for coming on the show with me. It's a pleasure. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
I appreciate you having me. Looking forward to it as well.
So for the folks in the audience who don't necessarily know who you are just yet, maybe you could just take a few minutes and talk a little bit about who you are and in your agency, and then we're going to dive really kind of deeply into this blueprint thing that I referred to earlier.
Sure. Yeah. So I started PR 2020 in 2005. It was started as a PR marketing agency, but I came from a traditional PR agency background. And so what had happened is in my 5+, almost 6 years at that agency, I started to really critically assess the traditional agency model. And I asked a lot of why questions, and there weren't always very good answers. So why do we use billable hours? Why do we offer these services, not those? Why don't we track what we're doing in different ways? So there was never really good responses. And in essence, what was happening is our agency at that time was being run, like many traditional agencies, on models that had been around for decades in some cases. Mm-hmm. And so in 2004, I just started kind of really questioning it. And I had this idea that I actually typed a paper called PR 2020. And it was going to be a new vision for the PR industry, kind of a new direction to go for agencies. And so I typed up what, you know, some people call that Jerry Maguire moment, that little one-page manifesto of things have to change. I didn't have answers yet, but I just felt things needed to change. And about a year and a half later, I basically just spent nights and weekends playing around with it. And at some point in October of 2004, we started a business for my wife as a fine artist. And I realized that even though I was in the industry, I had no idea how to get a website made for her, how to get a brochure made for her affordably. She couldn't afford our agency that I was at, and there really weren't services designed to help people like her. Mm-hmm. And then my parents own Cookies by Design franchises. And I was same thing, thinking, man, I've been in this industry for 4 or 5 years and I can't help my parents. So I tried to start building an agency model that could be more efficient and affordable for the mass market of small businesses. Mm-hmm. And that led me to move towards a model of standardized services and set pricing, very much a la carte, kind of a retail mix, where it was almost like buying off a shelf. You could see exactly what each thing cost. And that's the model I designed. And in July of 2005, I finished a business plan for it and presented it to my boss at the time. And he was interested in it, but you know, our timing and our goals were just different. And so that fall in November of 2005, I got $25,000 in debt financing and I left and I started the agency. So I decided on a Wednesday I was leaving, and that Sunday I got the $25,000 and put it in the bank. And the next Wednesday I handed in my resignation and walked. And so that was the start of PR 2020. And it was, so I had the idea and I had a general service guide in place that had 105 services in 19 categories. But I didn't have a website, I didn't have anything. And so we started it from there and then just kind of started building. And that was, so we've always done things differently, I guess, and looked at things more as what's possible versus what's been done. Mm-hmm. And never really got too caught up in what everyone else did and tried to kind of find our own way. And it was more pulling from best practices of other industries versus the marketing industry, which as a whole hadn't been very innovative up to that point.
I love it. Bravo, man. That's not entirely dissimilar to my story either, which probably my audience has heard many times, so I won't go into it again.
That's cool.
I want to... Before we get into the marketing agency blueprint, I want to ask you about that first month. You got $25,000 in debt financing, and then Monday comes. What did you do on Monday? How did you get your first client?
Yeah, I mean, it was the greatest feeling in life, was to walk away and have that freedom. So I've never looked back. I mean, to me, as soon as I started, it was just full steam ahead. And I was living and breathing it, staying up late, waking up early. You're just driven by everything you're doing. So for me, I couldn't work out of home. My wife, you know, was an artist that stayed at home. Well, she was working as a manager at a pottery studio at that time, but she was home quite a bit, and I couldn't work in a home office. So I spent a lot of time at Panera. Free Wi-Fi, free coffee refills was like all I needed in those days. So I just went to Panera, and I just sat there, and the first 2 months was really finding a web partner to build the site and finishing the service and pricing guide that was going to be the foundation of the brand. And that's really what I did. A 25 grand was meant to give me the flexibility to go probably 6 months without having income. So I could still pay my healthcare benefits and pay myself to cover my bills. But I was 27. My wife and I didn't really have many expenses. We didn't have kids. So I had a lot of freedom in terms of, I didn't need much money to get by. Mm-hmm. And, the first client ended up being a barter deal. It was with a local organization that Northern Isle PGA was actually the first client. So we bartered golf outings for services to get started. And then a couple of my past clients that I was not targeting, I never non-compete, but I didn't want to take any clients with me because I felt it was better to do it that way. A couple people came calling by January, so like 2 months in. And then what actually happened was word got out that I'd started it and that it was a very different alternative. And so people who had traditional agencies actually started calling me and saying, can you tell me about how your model works? I think we'd like to maybe get rid of our traditional agency and work with you. So people just found us through kind of my existing network. And it ended up evolving pretty quickly away from the small business model because larger enterprises were the ones that came calling.
The pricing model that you have, which I love, by the way, and that was one of the things that, that I did with my tech firm, is I killed the hourly thing and put it all a la carte and put the pricing on the website. And I think it was a huge differentiator. Did you do that right from the beginning, or was that something that came later?
Yeah, right from the beginning. It was actually more transparent than it is today, because today so much of what we do is bundled into monthly service packages. And at that time, there was a lot of a la carte, a lot more project work being done. And now we don't do as much project-based work. But the original one literally was a service and pricing, like a menu, and you could go through and look at brand marketing, public relations, email marketing, whatever it was, and you could click through and look at exact services, and then there was three tiers of pricing for every service. So in total, there was like 105 services, so what, 315 different services and pricing. It was absurd. I spent like 600 hours building that spreadsheet and then turning it into something online. So it was called the 2020 standard, was the original service guide. So today there's still pieces, like remnants of that within the site, but for the most part we've moved towards more of a kind of a software as a service type of model, like what you would see where there's three pricing levels and you get different features based on.
And so for the folks who are listening to this, if you're already chomping at the bit to go look at this, it's pr2020.com, right?
And that pricing model is actually about to be completely revolutionized, is probably a heavy word. It's going to be dramatically changed in the near future to completely eliminate word count and hours, which I've always wanted to get rid of, but I hadn't figured out a way yet. And I think we've finally figured out a way.
I want to talk a bit about that, because I think this is an important point, because I know when I was in the tech space, everyone was really, really concerned about billable hours, and they were very frightened of going to a fixed fee retainer per month, because they were worried, well, you know, what happens if I'm only charging them, you know, $2,000 a month, and then we use more than, say, for easy math, 20 hours, then I'm not getting as much. Do you look at your portfolio of clients that are paying you a retainer fee kind of like a portfolio of stocks, in that some of them are very profitable in a given month because you didn't end up having to do much, and then others maybe not quite as profitable because in that particular month you end up having to do more, but on balance, it ends up being a very attractive yield, for lack of a better term, on your portfolio. That's the way I looked at it. And I'm just curious if you see it any different way than that.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. We've always, even when we were all primarily project-based, we still looked at things as loss leaders. So we had projects within the portfolio that we looked at as like a strategic marketing plan, let's say. Mm-hmm. We may charge $5,000, but end up spending 125 hours on it. Mm-hmm. So in a billable hour model, you're eating a ton of time. In our model, it was a fixed price. They were paying for an output that they valued at $5,000. But that plan was designed to get them in the door. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at our portfolio today and our client base, you're definitely looking at, we monitor efficiency rates. So how efficiently we turn 1 hour service into X dollars of revenue, mm-hmm. but the client doesn't pay that hourly fee. We're just trying to hit that revenue target number. Mm-hmm. And so you have some clients that are going to naturally be more efficient and some that won't be as efficient and therefore as profitable. So an example would be like a client that just comes on in a highly technical B2B space. So let's say we're learning about machines or marketing or computer automation or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. A very technical industry that requires talking with engineers and learning scientific details about what they do. You're going to invest more time upfront learning mm-hmm. that account. Yeah. And then the idea becomes the longer you retain it, the more economies of scale you develop. And in theory, accounts should become more profitable the longer they stay, which is why so much of what we do is around retention and growth of our existing accounts versus spending all of our time trying to find new accounts. Mm-hmm. Because the ones that stick around longer should be more profitable. Mm-hmm. And so we do look at the portfolio and kind of grade out our clients based on a number of factors, profitability being one of them.
Mm-hmm. That's a very similar methodology to what a past guest of mine by the name of Mike Michlowitz, and I swear I must plug this guy's book in every interview I do. So, Mike, if you're listening, I hope you're laughing. But his book's called The Pumpkin Plan, and if you haven't read it, it's a really, really good read, and it's really about focusing on the best and most profitable clients and figuring out how to replicate those clients and getting rid of all the other ones that are actually taking away from your profit margin.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to talk about your marketing agency blueprint. Before I do that, just so folks who don't know you, how big is your agency now? How many employees and how much revenue are you doing?
We have 12, and we'll do probably between $1 million and $2 million this year in revenue.
Okay. And is that, you're obviously more familiar with the marketing agency space than I am. Is that average size, bigger than average, smaller than average?
People have differing opinions. It's probably a small to mid-sized firm, depending on who you talk to, which publication you look at. I'm a big one on growth for growth's sake doesn't interest me. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of people get caught up in that. We've spent most of our time trying to scale growth back. So we've actually purposely stayed to the size we are versus doubling growth. Cause there was a 5-year stretch where we grew like 500% and some. Mm-hmm. It was like 4 or 5 year stretch. And we literally were growing at 100% rate. And it was not manageable cause we didn't have the infrastructure. And that's so much what the Marketing Agency Blueprint book is about. It's not necessarily about how do you dramatically accelerate growth and keep the pedal to the metal. It's more about building a solid infrastructure for a company that can sustain growth and become more profitable than the average firm. Mm-hmm. And so I'm far more interested in building a model that has higher profit margins and is a greater efficiency than I am size of employee count and revenue count. I don't really set goals on those two areas, I guess.
Well, it's at the end of the day, it's your private company. You don't have anyone to report to. Profit is more important than revenue. If you're making $10 million in revenue and no profit, you just have stress in your life and a lot of moving parts to manage.
Right.
Whereas if you could do $1 million in revenue with 500 grand in profit, life would be pretty good.
That's okay.
All right. So let's shift and talk. And I want you to use your firm as much as an example as you can, but feel free to use other examples to illustrate the points that we're going to talk about in the marketing agency blueprint. So I think I know why you created it. You saw, it doesn't matter my opinion, why did you create it?
The backstory to the book is in 2007, so when we were about 2 years old, I came across a company called HubSpot, which makes inbound marketing software, all-in-one inbound marketing software. So people, if they're not familiar with HubSpot, They have about $100 million in venture capital funding. It started in 2006 by Brian Halligan and Dharmesh Shah. And they've grown to, I think, about 450 employees now. And they just expanded into Europe. And we're going to hire another couple hundred this year. So it's a very fast-growing software company. In 2007, we connected with them. And we actually signed up for their software as a customer of theirs. So we were going to start implementing their software, which enables like blogging and search engine optimization and content management. And now today, email marketing and complete sales funnel, lead nurturing and loyalty building and everything you need to do. So we started using it mainly actually to train our staff because they had awesome methodology and great education. And so we were using it to adapt our personnel and teach them how to become evolved professionals, what we term in the book hybrid professionals. Mm-hmm. And then in early 2008, we actually started seeing this market opportunity to bundle our services because we already had the pricing model to do it with their software. Mm-hmm. And so in the early going of their growth, when they were just a few hundred customers, there weren't agencies they were working with that helped their clients get more value out of the software. And so we were the first to do that. And so they actually started referring opportunities to us of customers that wanted their software but didn't want to do the work themselves or couldn't do the work themselves. So that's when our growth started really accelerating, you know, the 100% plus growth per year. Mm-hmm. And then about a year and a half later, they actually put a strategy behind building a VAR program. And they've since created a program kind of around that original model we developed with them. And they've built it to about 800 or 900 certified firms worldwide. Mm-hmm. And a large portion of their revenue and growth now comes from agencies. So what happened was, as we were growing, we had agencies all around the world copying our model, literally scraping content from our website, leaving links back to our product pages on their sites. It was absurd. So, you know, here we were, like, the first few years of the agency, I tried to stay under the radar, and I didn't really want people knowing what we were doing and didn't want people kind of judging or copying. And, you know, I just wanted to create it and then see where it went. Mm-hmm. And so we spent a couple years with people just copying everything. And, you know, it was kind of a weird time. And so I don't know, HubSpot kept pushing, like, why don't you get out in front and talk and educate other people? And I thought, all I'm going to do is teach competitors how to do what we're doing. Like, why would I do that? Mm-hmm. And then fast forward to December of 2010, and I got a message from someone on Twitter, a direct message that said she was building her country's first inbound marketing agency because of us. And this was someone in Romania. Mm-hmm. And so I woke up to that. That was a message on my phone when I rolled out of bed at like 6 a.m. And I thought, man, that's really interesting. So on the ride in that day, I actually decided, screw it. We're going to share everything we've learned, and in hopes of advancing the industry and the agency ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And if we do that enough and create enough value, there'll be benefits for us down the road. But my basic premise was, there's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people wanting to build agencies or that have agencies already, maybe solo shops and maybe a few people. But those people had no aspirations of what we intend to do. So the type of firm we want to build, the scope we want to build it to, these are people that want to make a living, probably mm-hmm. stay, you know, 1 to 5 people, maybe 10, mm-hmm. and they just want to do good things and help businesses grow. And so I felt we'd been through enough that we could accelerate their ability to do that. We could share what we'd learned, the pains we'd gone through, the lessons we've found out along the way, and hopefully fast forward their growth or their development as an agency a year or two maybe in the process. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I decided. So I got to the office that day. It was like December 10th, 2010. I emailed my friend at HubSpot who ran the VAR program and said, hey, here's what I'm ready to do. Would you guys be behind this? Will help us spread this? He said, absolutely. So that was December. And then that March of 2011, I was at South by Southwest, and David Meerman Scott, who's a friend of mine, had me come to the Wiley party with them and introduced me to his editor that night. And then from there, about a month later, about 30 days later, the editor from Wiley and I agreed on the marketing agency blueprint title, and I signed the deal. And 3 months later, the book was done. I had 90 days to write it. And so I wrote it, and it came out in December of 2011. That was really it. It wasn't something I set out to do. I never had set this career goal of I've got to have a book by the age of, you know, 34. And it just sort of happened. Mm-hmm. And it's been wonderful. I mean, it's gratifying to hear the stories from people who've have realized what we set out to do, which was help them develop their businesses. Mm-hmm. And the book was very much about not who we were, but what we thought was possible for agencies. And there's definitely lessons learned, and we do tell the inside story behind the growth of PR 2020, but it's not a book about PR 2020.
Mm-hmm. So has the marketing agency blueprint now become a revenue generating entity for you, or is this?
Yeah, we launched marketingagencyinsider.com to coincide with the book.
Yeah.
And that's become, because we don't offer consulting and services to other agencies. So like mentoring and coaching, we get a lot of requests for that. Mm-hmm. We don't offer that, but we do have webinars, paid webinars. And we've done two series. We did the Blueprint series in February of last year, which was like a $500 person thing. We've had 80 or 90 agencies take that. And then in October of 2012, we launched the Client Services series, which we created a hypothetical B2B company and then did a 7-part webinar series on a year in the life of that company and ran like the whole hypotheticals of how would you build the campaigns, how would you create the scorecards. And so we've had probably 50 or 60 agencies go through that, and that's like $695 is the rate for that. So we leveraged the book to do online education, which has been a very profitable piece of the business last year.
And do those courses still sell kind of on a passive basis? People are just showing up every now and again and buying them, or does it require active promotion on your part?
They're available on demand. They're promoted through the Marketing Agency Insider site, which we do invest a lot of resources in continuing to build that community.
Yeah.
So people do naturally find it through there. We passively promote it through other agency properties and mainly through like social networks and email marketing with our other properties. And when I say other properties, I mean PR 2020. And then we just launched software called Marketing Score in December of last year. So it's connected through that. So it's passively promoted through those. And then we're in talks right now to launch a full-blown agency academy that would be the Client Services series was a test. And it was a test that validated an idea of how to do online learning differently. Mm-hmm. And so now we're in the process of figuring out how heavily we want to invest in that. So again, we're going back to the revenue question. We've spent the last like 18 months building foundations to take a leap forward, a leap forward for us, and then hopefully a leap forward for the industry. And some things are publicly known, many things aren't. And so that's really, rather than me spending my time trying to grow incrementally the service side of our business, I've been building things behind the scenes to take those leaps, I guess.
Terrific. In one of the promo videos that I watched in my research, I want to shift gears now and talk about some tactics that the agency owners, I know for sure there's people listening to this who are that one man solo agency, or maybe they're
lots
even a 3-person agency. There's lots and lots of those people. And they all struggle with how do I get more customers? How do I get more leads? I know HubSpot did a survey. Number one pain point for agencies was unpredictable revenue. So they're wondering, how can I get more retainer clients? And these all are areas where you have demonstrated expertise. So I want to talk about them. Sure. So you mentioned something about 10 rules in a video that I watched. Can you talk a little bit about what those 10 rules are? We don't kind of describe what they are as opposed to going through all 10 of them, because people can go and find those rules and listen to them.
The premise behind the book was 10 rules for building a modern marketing agency, like a tech-savvy hybrid agency. And so each chapter is one of the rules. So when it comes to what you're talking about, bringing in that new business, even at the early stages of a single person, because that is one of the most common questions we get, is how do you get that first client? How do you get that first retainer account? How do you build that civilian? How do I know when it's time to hire the first employee? So there are far more people out there trying to answer those questions than there are trying to figure out how to go from 25 to 50 employees.
Yeah.
They have different problems. So most people are in that smaller size and trying to figure out how to take those next steps. I think one of the big takeaways from the book that's really sort of universal through all 10 rules is to differentiate by doing. There's really no way to bring in the new business without proving you have the ability to do it for yourself first. And then it's a backwards way of thinking, because historically agencies have dealt with themselves last. The agency website is never according to them, up to their brand standards or what the quality they do for clients. They don't do anything besides send out press releases or file the win awards for their work. It's really pretty pathetic how the industry has marketed itself historically. But the change that's happened and the way inbound marketing works has leveled the playing field. It doesn't take massive amounts of budget or time to be exceptional at marketing yourself. And our feeling has always been, because our growth, we've never gone looking for new business. We don't do sales. We don't have any outbound sales. Our salespeople are our consultants. So everything we've grown through is organic. People have come through us through referral or through our website. So we've grown by publishing ebooks, doing webinars, having a blog, building strong personal brands for our employees who are active on social networks, being out in the community, being out through organizations. Like, we've just done the stuff we teach our clients how to do. And so if it ever comes to a question of, well, can you guys do this? And especially in those early days where you don't have the client roster to refer to, then you can say, well, look at what we've done with our agency. Our site went from 500 visitors a month to 1,400 to 5,000. And we built our blog from 3 subscribers to 300 in the last year. Like, you can prove you have the ability to do it by doing it for yourself. And to me, it's just, it's hard work and it's not a quick fix, and everybody wants a quick fix, but that's the answer. You just have to do it. Mm-hmm. And so many people just don't want to, or just can't. They can't commit the energy needed to make it happen.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more with so many people are looking for that quick fix. And I don't know if you heard the interview, but I had a fellow on recently, Marcus Sheridan.
Marcus is awesome.
Yeah, he is awesome. I'm sure you know him, the sales lion. And you know, his pool business, there was nothing complicated about what he did. He just said, I'm getting killed here because of the economy's downturn. I need more leads. So what's every question that someone could ever ask before they would want to buy a pool? And I'm going to create answers to all of those questions on my blog.
Yep.
And he shared with me some of the results that he got, and phenomenal. Absolutely.
It's a brilliantly simple approach that anybody can do. And the space has gotten noisy since he did that, in terms of there's a lot of people following that approach now. And he's going all around the world speaking about the approach. Mm-hmm. So it's becoming, it's also a quality play now. So not only do you have to have the strategy, but you have to actually be committed to doing it in a very quality way. And that's what Marcus has always done. And, you know, again, he differentiates by doing. He's out there working his ass off, and he's still blogging, and he's still out there doing the speaking circuit, and he just worked harder than everybody else.
Yeah.
So you got to love it.
Funny how that works, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, so your advice then to the one person, I talked to a guy maybe a month ago now. He was doing about $150,000 a year in revenue, doing it all himself, everything, and killing himself doing it, and had no time whatsoever. How does that guy make the transition from being the one man show to a real entrepreneur when he's got some staff working for him? Because there's lots of levers he can pull, right? Like, he could pull the hiring lever. He could pull the, I want to get more customers, so because I think I need more revenue before I hire lever, or I could spend all my time blogging and stop going to all these, you know, like, what does he do? What advice would you give?
To me, it's a unique answer in each situation. And it's mainly because, like, chapter 10 of the book is titled Pursue Purpose. And I think that's what it is. I have to double check now. But the whole idea is, the question you need to ask is, what is the goal of building this? Like, why am I building a firm? Mm-hmm. And so for me, early on, I had every intention from day one of building a firm of lasting significance. I wanted to build something that I was going to spend my career in, and that was going to create opportunities for other people. I wanted to develop talent. I wanted to hire and retain them. And, you know, I wanted to build something that had an impact. So the questions, when you ask questions, they have to be within the context of, why are you doing it? And so if someone at that one person phase just wants to make $150,000 a year and not have to report to anybody, your growth path is going to be very different than if you want to build a 50 or 100 person firm that lasts for 50 years. And so for me, like, I mean, I've been doing this 7 years now. Every day I make a conscious decision to forego personal wealth in favor of building the firm. Mm-hmm. Because personal wealth isn't what's driving me right now. You know, I need, mm-hmm. I'm certainly building equity in what we're doing, I could care less how much I'm making right now. I pay my bills and I put some money away. Mm-hmm. But my employees are developing and they're building their wealth. And to me, that's more important right now. Mm-hmm. So I think once you answer that question, why am I doing it? Then you need to figure out, okay, what steps make the most sense to take then? And so if you're okay with making 50 grand a year, whatever you can afford to pay yourself, and you can sacrifice the other money you'd like to be making, but you can use that to hire that first employee who can work in the business, and you can now go to work on the vision and the growth and the business development and putting infrastructure in place and building career paths for the employees. It just depends on what that next step is. And so for me, I've always put funding in place to enable me to not make rash decisions or irrational decisions. I think desperation is the worst thing that can mm-hmm. happen to a business owner or a business executive. Mm-hmm. So I've always made every effort to have a runway, a funding runway there. So I was never making those desperate decisions. And mm-hmm. that's enabled me to hire sometimes at need, sometimes before need. When the right person's there, you make mm-hmm. that hire because you know that person's instrumental to get you where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And if you know where you're trying to get to, then should I hire a salesperson? Should I hire an account executive? Should I hire whomever that next person is? It becomes easier to make that decision within the context of why you're growing the company.
Okay, so let's say that we'll give a mock answer that the person that we're talking about wants to get to, say, the size of firm that you've built currently. Mm-hmm. They may not have aspirations to go beyond that, but they want to get to, like, you know, 10 people, a couple million dollars a year in revenue. They're at one person now. Should they be focusing, should they hire someone so they can get some of that creative off of their plate so they can spend more time producing blog content to drive more leads, or what?
Yeah, from an agency perspective, it's probably the most important question, because what I've seen historically is a lot of people start marketing agencies because they're very good marketers. And so they can excel at doing the work. And so that's naturally what they mm-hmm. want to be doing. The reality is, if you're going to start hiring people and build a business, you have to be a better business person than you do a marketer, unless you have a partner who's going to run the business. Mm-hmm. So the best advice I can give is get out of the way as quickly as possible on the service side of your business, because someone needs to set the vision, grow the company, recruit and retain the talent, and that someone needs to be the leader of the company. And in most cases, that's going to be the entrepreneur who started it. So you're doing the company and the clients a disservice if you're spending 140 hours a month of your time doing client work, mm-hmm. when that 140 hours could be going towards building the vision and the culture behind the company. The hard part for people to accept is there are a lot of people who can replace you on the service side. Mm-hmm. It's a very hard thing to replace vision of a CEO or a founder. And so you have to understand where your value lies and then be willing to get out of the way on the other stuff.
And people that you talk to, do you think that that's one of the biggest struggles they have, is making that mental shift that they need to stop working in the business and spend more of their time working on it?
Yeah, I don't think it's always for the same reason, though. I think there's a lot of people who would gladly get out of the way and start mm-hmm. working on the business itself, but they don't know how, or they don't have the money in place to hire that first person. They don't know who to hire. Mm-hmm. It goes back to, many people who start agencies aren't trained to be business owners. Mm-hmm. You don't go to school for it. So I don't know that it's always that they're not willing to get out of the way. It's they don't know how, I guess would be the.
So let's say that they're thinking, yeah, the money, I don't have the money, I can't afford this. You got a $25,000, I'm assuming it was an SBA loan or something like that.
Friends and family.
Okay. So yeah. Do you
think that was the first loan?
Yeah. And then there was
many other ones.
I know exactly what that's like. I was 400 grand in debt at one point, $400,000. And if it all failed, I had no assets to sell to pay off this. Yeah. I was done. But that's a whole
good for you, man.
Yeah.
No,
it's
the dirty truth behind building a business. People don't want to tell you about, you know, how you're, you know, there wasn't a long time ago that I was close to pushing the button and liquidating all my retirement assets to fund the growth of the company myself. I mean, it was probably 12 hours away from pushing the button, but you don't, but you're willing to, and I wouldn't have thought twice about it. You know, I didn't want to do it, but you do. And that's, if you believe in what you're building, you're willing to do it.
And that's exactly what happened to me. I completely and totally ran out of money.
Yeah.
And here's a phrase that maybe you'll want to use. When I gave talks and people used to ask me, you know, what do you need to do to be successful? I used to say, well, you need to embrace economic pressure, which is another fancy way of saying bury yourself so far in debt that you have no option but to continue moving forward.
Yeah.
It can be pretty scary. And at the time, I did not have a wife or children to look after. So it was only my rear end that was on the line. If I had the other responsibilities, I probably would have taken a different approach. All right, now I've sidelined us. Where was I? So, yes, getting the money. Do you think that it's a legitimate excuse to stay at one? Oh, I don't know where to find the money. Or do you think it's just an excuse and that people, they can figure it out if they're really motivated to?
That's a tough one. I don't want to assume that everyone has access to capital. I think in today's market, it's easier to access than people think, because there's a lot of money on the sidelines right now. Mm-hmm. So if you think about just the friends and family network before you even get to like the angel investor network and other, you know, options, there are a lot of wealthy individuals who have significant amounts of money sitting there gaining less than a percent of interest a year. If you can offer convertible note options, there are a lot of different financial vehicles you can look at to get access to money that can give individual investors a far greater return than what they're getting in the market or not in the market. Mm-hmm. And so I would say, if you believe in what you're doing and you believe you can create tremendous value through it, I wouldn't be shy about talking with people because they're looking for opportunities. Mm-hmm. Now, banks are a different story. Banks serve a very important role in our economy. Funding small business growth, in my opinion, is not one of them at this stage in the economy. No. You need money to get money is pretty much what it comes down to. So there are certainly wonderful programs, probably through the SBA and through, I think Goldman Sachs probably does stuff. And I mean, there's people trying to do programs to fund small business growth, but I would say you're fooling yourself if you think you can fund your growth strictly through borrowing from banks. It's a very tricky thing to go through right now. So we've tried everything. We've had equity lines on homes. We've, you know, taken out term loans. We've borrowed from friends and family. And we recently actually put private equity funding and raised a significant rounding for our growth. But that's not the way to go for many companies. But for us, it was finally a good time to do it.
Yeah, it's not even an option for very many companies, as a matter of fact.
No.
Paul, there's a noise outside my office. Somebody's making too much noise. Can I ask you to hang on 1 second? I'm going to be right back.
Yeah, go for it.
So raising private equity is not something that's an option for a whole lot of people, especially running a service business where you don't necessarily have intellectual property. So I do want to find out how you managed to get some institutional money.
The general rule, if you look at the simplest way of valuing a company, and every expert you read has wildly different ways of determining valuations, but a simple one would be a multiple of revenue. So let's just say traditionally a marketing agency, a service company may be able to get one, maybe up to three times revenue if it's a really great company. Mm-hmm. So if you're a $1 million company, you may be able to get 1 to 3 million in terms of valuation of your company. Mm-hmm. And then when you start playing in the software world, it expands. And so I've looked at a number of software as a service companies, and the publicly traded companies would be, you know, roughly in the 5 to 6 time multiple of revenue. But then you have some that are dramatically higher than that. So in essence, to raise the valuation, you have to have much higher potential, or you have to have some crazy model that brings in dramatically high net profit margins. Mm-hmm. So if you're making 20, 25, 30% margins, then you can probably raise some pretty decent money. but you also probably don't need the money if you're making 20 or 30% net margins. So for us, the agency evolved. We, you know, when I wrote the book, a lot of what we talked about in there was theoretical, that, you know, it was where we thought the agency world could go and what appeared to be possible. And since then, we've kind of brought some of that to life. So we moved into the online education world, which obviously has significantly higher profit margins than services.
Sorry, the internet
software.
Sorry, Paul, the internet slowed down for a minute there. You said you moved into the online something world. We missed that word.
Okay. Yeah. The online education. So like the marketing agency insider stuff we were talking about, where you can, you know, in theory, make money while you're sleeping. People can buy on-demand licenses to stuff that, you know, you create once and then you can monetize almost infinitely. So we, you know, we first moved in that direction and we added that layer to the business, which has some pretty sizable potential. And then in May of last year, we started building software for the first time and we released Marketing Score in December of 2012. It's a free assessment tool right now, but there's absolutely a product roadmap behind it that has significant revenue potential. And so when you start looking at, we have the service business, which does well, could be more profitable, but again, it, so much of this is by design because I'm more focused on building long-term than short-term returns. So you have the service model, you have an education model, you have a software model, and then there's a few other revenue streams as well. And now all of a sudden, you can build a company that has a far greater valuation because it has far greater potential for returns. And so once we had that story to tell, we luckily have a network of individuals that that have the ability to make investments. And we had some people that for a couple of years had expressed interest in investing. And I was never comfortable giving up the equity that would have been necessary because our valuation would have been too low. And once we had a different story, we had the ability to reach a different valuation that I was far more comfortable with. And so we could raise the amount of money we needed without having to give up a great amount of equity in the company. So, and again, it's kind of that option of, like you had said, do you go $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in debt, or at some point, if you can raise the money through investment rather than through debt, you can balance your books a lot better and life looks a little rosier. So we took money. I didn't take anything off the table. And this actually, I don't even think I've ever publicly shared that we took money. So this is kind of the first time I've been talking about it. But it all went into the business. It's all going to fuel growth that most of which people aren't seeing the fruits of yet. It's stuff that we're working on behind the scenes.
So. How much did you raise?
I won't get into that. It was it was a significant amount for a company of our size, and it was from an angel investor. I'll say that.
Okay. And so, last question on this fundraising: the angel investor, did they bring? I call it smart money when they bring more than the check. They bring contacts or some other asset, intellectual asset, to the table.
Yeah, for me, that was essential. We had a list of like 10 to 12 people that we were going to approach, and the first person on the list is the one who invested.
Well, that's nice.
So, yeah, it was nice. It took an hour. So it was a good use of an hour. A couple hours to build the deck, but an hour to land the investment. Yeah, I think anybody who's looking at that, and whether it's business partners or silent partners through investments, whatever it may be, or even advisory board, they always have to add something. Money, and again, I don't want to sound trite or trivializing this for people who don't necessarily know where to go for money. Raising the money is the easy part. Like, there's money out there if you know the right people and if you have the right story. You need the right money from the right person. Otherwise, I mean, it's kind of like growth for growth's sake. Just building revenue means nothing if you're not doing it for the right reasons, if you don't have an end goal in mind. And I feel raising money is very much the same way. It needs to come from the right people.
So to put that in perspective for the listeners, Uncle Dave, who knows nothing about your business, is willing to invest a chunk at a higher valuation, which would be more favorable for you. And then super smart Phil, who has connections and expertise and other intellectual assets, is also willing to invest the same amount of money, but he's going to do it at maybe half the valuation of Uncle Dave. Which money are you going to take?
It's kind of, I mean, if you've ever watched Shark Tank, in essence, it's what entrepreneurs on that show have to balance. It's okay, if I'm getting an offer for $1 million from each of these three people, and they're all basically asking for around the same percentage of the company, whose money is worth more to me because they're adding either expertise or retail distribution or that network, whatever it may be. That you can't look at just the dollars as the way to value an investment.
Yeah, absolutely not. Because there's so much that a shrewd, connected investor can bring to the table, because now they're your partner. They want to do everything in their power to help you succeed, because it's a self-interest for them. That's how they're going to get the biggest bang for their buck. All right. I got a little down a rabbit hole there. We're going to go back. I want to talk. We talked a little bit about lead generation. I don't know if we've covered that in enough detail yet. I want to come and give, if we can get some bullet points on what you think that solopreneur who wants to get to, say, you know, 3 or 5 or 10 people, what are, just rattle off the activities. What do you think are the top 5 activities that they should be doing on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis?
Well, it starts with figure out the best way to package and present your expertise. And if that can come across, I think the obvious ones and the most affordable ones are things like podcasts, blogging, webinars, white papers, ebooks. It almost always comes back to content. What content can you create that demonstrates a unique expertise and shows your personality? Because so many people, professionals in the marketing world in particular, are starting to sound the same, and they're starting to offer very similar services. So you want to be able to establish a connection. There's a great study that Google did for their Zero Moment of Truth program, and they have a website for it and everything. And they showed that in 2010, the average consumer would look at like 5.7, and I can never get the decimal points right, but say it's 5.7 sources of information before making a buying decision. In 2000, well, the next year, 12 months later, it was like 10.8. So in essence, over a 12-month period, the amount of information people would look at before making a buying decision, this applies in the business-to-business world as well, doubled. In other words, they're consuming far more information. Well, that information is being found in blog posts and ebooks and white papers and webinars and case studies and podcasts. And so you need to be considering the fact that your buyers or your prospective buyers, these leads you want to bring in, are looking for information. And like Marcus Sheridan said in, you know, his talk, what questions are they asking? Answer questions. And the more value you can create, the more questions you can answer through your content, the greater chance you have of getting them into your marketing funnel at the lead stage. And then from there, it's all about nurturing in the sales process.
And for anyone listening who maybe hasn't gone down this content creation road, and you're thinking about, well, you know, well, what would I create? All you got to do is think about the questions. As soon as you have 50 questions that your potential customer can ask, you have 50 topics that you can write about, that you can interview other people about, that you can create ebooks and webinars about. You will have more ideas than you have time to create the content. I can promise you that.
And I know you've interviewed Joe Polizzi as well. Joe's with the Content Marketing Institute. And so if you're new to the content game and you want to kind of learn what's going on, go to Content Marketing Institute's website, attend Content Marketing World. I mean, there are lots of professionals who have succeeded at doing this who are very open about telling you how they've done it. And I would say use those resources.
I don't think it's rocket science. It just takes work. That's it.
Yep.
Okay. Let's talk about generating retainer revenue, because that, if you're going to build your firm, as I'm sure you're well aware, and I definitely was, retainers are where it's at, because it's less stressful. The revenue is more predictable. So that's great. But your company is also worth a lot more money, so that when you want to raise money or sell it or take a partner or whatever, you're in a much, much better position of negotiation because you've got that predictable revenue. So how do you think, like, people, these one man, the one man shop that we keep talking about, probably doing a lot of web design, maybe some press releases, maybe some social stuff. What should they be doing to, in terms of services, to generate recurring revenue? And then how do they get that shift happening in their head, and how do they communicate it to clients so they can get the client to say, yes, I will take a retainer?
That's the main premise behind the book, is teaching people how to be a hybrid agency, because I think that's really what you have to be to make it work, to be able to create. For us, the most important metric, and I would argue for any service firm, as you're saying, is the recurring revenue number. What is the number we know we're going to hit every month, month over month, and we want that number always growing. Mm-hmm. And we want it to be as large a percentage of our total revenue as possible, mm-hmm. because it's predictable. So you have to know how you're going to get there. And oftentimes, if you're just doing web work or graphic design work or just writing content, it's very hard to build service packages around siloed projects or siloed services. And so the premise in the book is you have to look at becoming an integrated firm. You have to consider the fact that CMOs are looking for integrated services. There's been studies showing that the importance of integrated services is dramatically increasing, and yet there's one study that shows 71% of CMOs have no idea where to turn for integrated services from firms. They don't know what firm is going to provide those. Mm-hmm. So CMOs are trying to simplify the matrix of agencies they work with, but they need, you know, an ebook needs to have a landing page on a website, and ideally you want to A/B test that landing page. So you're going to have a graphic design component, you're going to have a copywriting component, you're going to have a web component just to publish the ebook. Then you want to spread it through social media channels. You want to have an email lead nurturing campaign that's automated for people that download it. You want to automatically segment the people that download it by company size, by industry, by whether they're a marketer or agency, whatever it may be. All of these things go into running a campaign. Then on the back end, you need to monitor the analytics and look at download rates and look at the click-through rates on the follow-up email nurturing campaigns. That's what marketing is today. You can't create an ebook and then hand it off to somebody else and hope they build a social strategy and then hope they, you know, the ad team does something with it and integrate. It doesn't work. So the first step is really to understand where the marketing industry is going and has gone, and then figure out how you can actually take your services, fit them into that model. It may require that you build some partnerships or some expertise you don't have. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you need to actually model your plans and pricing in that style. So like in our case, where someone comes to our website, it's pretty obvious that we have service packages, and mm-hmm. those service packages are a monthly recurring program. Well, that's the first step, because now the expectation when someone reaches out to us is they get that we primarily run ongoing programs, retainers, if you know mm-hmm. you want to call them those. So it's in part a structuring of your business model and a part a positioning, which requires really thinking critically about your plans and pricing.
In your service business, what percentage of total revenue comes from retainer?
Ours is probably about 90% at this point.
90. That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost exclusively that now.
It's it's such a... For the folks that aren't there yet, I can promise you this, and I know Paul will nod in agreement. When you come in on the first day of every month and you're not back at zero and you're going, oh man, how am I going to crack my nut this month? Instead, you know, in my case, it was about $78,500 hit my bank account on the first day of every month. And that was pretty much my overhead for the month.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And yeah. It allows you to sit back and be a bit more strategic. You talked about creating a runway for yourself so that you didn't have to make decisions under duress. There's no way I ever could have sold my business for what I did if I didn't have that recurring revenue. So I'm a huge evangelist, and that's why every opportunity I get, when I have someone like you, Paul, who has demonstrated, you know, that this can be done, that I really want to kind of jump all over it for a bit, because it's the game changer. It is. Yeah.
Well, and one of the things we preach a lot about, and I've done a number of talks on, is you can't get so caught up in getting to that number. So let's say your break even is 78,000. For us, for a couple of years, that was our goal, was to get the recurring mm-hmm. revenue to the break even point. And everything else over that was gravy.
Yeah.
But once you get there, churn happens. Clients leave for all kinds of reasons that are completely out of your control. Yeah. Mergers and acquisitions, bankruptcies, you name it, we've had clients leave for it. We fired our biggest client last year. And then 2 days later, a Fortune 500 company closed the division that we were working for and doing phenomenal things for. So overnight, our two largest accounts are basically gone. And so as an agency, you have to prepare for those contingencies. And that's why I say it's so much more important as an agency to have retention programs in place, to know that once you get them through the sales funnel and they're now a customer, the real work begins then. Getting them through that point takes a science and an art, but keeping them is where the, you know, the money's really made and the profits are made.
Can you talk a bit more about retention programs then? Can you give some advice?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that it's, there's obvious things like customer service that come into play, but for us, everything comes down to performance. So we've, again, lost clients for everything you could possibly imagine. And what my directive internally has been is that I don't do the client service work. I spend probably less than 5 hours a month on client services. So my feeling was if I get a call from a client out of the blue and they say, hey, we're thinking of leaving, what value are you guys bringing right now for the $10,000 a month we pay or whatever it is, that I could log into their scorecard. We build custom scorecards for clients. And in 3 seconds, I could spit out, well, in the last 3 months, your lead conversion rate is up 3%. Lead volume is up 34% over the previous 3 month average. Your customer conversion rate is this, and we've helped reduce your churn rate by 2%.
End of phone call.
Yeah. If you want to leave, I understand. Like, if there's anything else I can do for you, let me know. Mm-hmm. So I'll accept that there are ways you lose clients that are out of your control, but I want to control as many variables as possible. And the best one I know how is to actually deliver valuable performance to them and to be very transparent in showing them.
Are you using HubSpot's tools to produce the numbers that you just rattled off, or is that something that you've built that plugs into HubSpot? How's that work?
We use a blend of HubSpot and Google Analytics for pretty much every client. And then our custom scorecards are actually built in Google Drive.
Okay. So using their form builder, something like that?
We actually just built spreadsheets. Okay. And then we can run pivot tables on those if we want.
Okay.
So we, I guess we haven't probably shared it publicly. We shared it as the template as part of the client services series we did. Mm-hmm. So we made all of our templates for everything we do, even because then we do monthly scorecards and monthly game plans, and then we actually provide a deck each month that we build in Keynote that highlights the active campaigns, how those campaigns are performing, what's coming up next month, how the analytics from the previous month have actually affected the strategy moving forward. So we try and run kind of agile, real-time programs based on performance. And mm-hmm. if something didn't work, we're the first ones to tell the client, this didn't work, and here's why. And we even A/B tested it and it didn't work in either the case. So here's what we're going to do next month. And so the more transparent we are, I think the more credibility and trust you have with the client.
Yeah, absolutely. So you say you're building a deck each month for them to basically convey, here's what we've done for you lately.
Right. We, knowing that many of our client contacts forward things on to the C-suite if we're not working with the C-suite themselves, like a marketing manager, marketing director. So we have spreadsheets and we have beautiful Google Analytics reports and all those things, but most clients don't want to spend time on that. Yeah. So we try and condense it to like 8 to 10 slides that they could easily forward on to their bosses. And, you know, so again, hopefully everyone understands the value we're bringing, or in the early stages, the efforts you're putting in, that, but that, you know, those are designed to contribute to some measurable outcome.
How big is your average client?
Probably like 6,000 to 7,000 a month right now, I would say.
No, well, that okay. That's not the answer I was looking for, but that's a good one.
It's all over the place. Some of our larger accounts are actually small businesses, so people like doing 10 million or less that are spending 7,000-8,000 a month, probably.
Yeah.
And then you have Fortune 500 companies where we may work with a division of a multi-billion-dollar company, but we're not like agency of record for. Yeah. Fortune 500s with $1 million budgets. So it's, I mean, you could average it, but the average would mean nothing. It's kind of all across the board. And we actually just had this conversation last week trying to define the prototype customer. And it's a hard thing to come up with.
They have pre-signed checks. They keep them in the right-hand drawer of their desk, and they hand them to you when you walk in the door.
Those are good ones.
All right. We have been an hour. I'm going to, I could go all day. I got some, some, like I say, I want to show you the software interface here when we get off, offline. So, last three questions, these ones are quick and easy. What are you most excited about for 2013?
Marketing Score. We're building software that's the, and it's themarketingscore.com if anyone's curious, but it's only the beginning. There's some really cool things that we're working on that we've alluded to. Like we talked about origins of a marketing intelligence engine. I wrote a blog post for that. And it's basically what we think is possible. And we're moving in that direction rather than waiting for the industry to get there. We're just kind of going in that direction ourselves. So I'm very excited about the potential of what we can build.
Yeah. Nice, nice looking landing page, by the way. Very, very 2013. What book are you reading right now, or books that you're enjoying?
Well, I'm reading Mastery by Robert Greene right now. And Robert Greene's actually one of my favorite authors. His writing style takes a little getting used to because it's a little long-winded at times with his...
You think?
His examples. But you can learn to actually read past those. And just... So I actually skip the story in each chapter and I get to the...
Thank you. I read his book Mastery and I'm going, okay, example number 17 of the same point. Skip, 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 skip. It got to the point where I would just kind of skim to the end of the chapter where he would give the, like, the more or less summary.
Yep. That's really all you need. Yeah, he wrote one with 50 Cent called The 50th Law, and they would start each chapter with a story about 50 Cent's life. You can skip it. You don't need the 50 Cent part. Just skip to the, like, what the application is. So that's every book he's done is like that.
Okay.
So I'm reading that. I just finished Automate This, which is phenomenal. And if you talk about, you know, what I was alluding to earlier about where we're going as an agency and where I think the industry is going, that gives a great prelude to it.
Okay.
So if you look at what happened on the stock market and Wall Street and what's happening in the healthcare world, and you sit back and ponder how that could affect marketing, that's kind of the direction we're going.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
and my last question. How can people get a hold of you?
I mean, they can visit the website, obviously, pr2020.com.
Okay.
The Marketing Score site is themarketingscore.com. And they can email me, paul@pr2020.com, if they'd like.
All right. Paul, really enjoyed this interview.
Thanks so much.
I feel like we've had just so much in common, so many similar beliefs about how to run a business. I wish when I was running mine, I would have been I would have known about information marketing, and I would have had the epiphany to think, you know, hey, maybe there's a lot of people who'd like to know what I'm doing, and I could have created a whole nother business. But I wasn't
there's
even
still
on,
time.
Wasn't even on my radar screen. Well, that's kind of what Bright Ideas is all about. But
yeah, you're doing it now.
I pretty much am. All right, my friend. Well, thank you so much for making the time to be on the show. You can come back anytime you want. I probably will bring you back in the not too distant future because I've got another sort of like series of discussions that they're not so much about building a firm, but they're actually about the creative and the tactics. So you'll probably be on my list of people for that.
I'll show you something we're working on then.
Cool. All right. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Jim.
If you'd like to get access to the show notes for this episode, go to brightideas.co/35. And if you run a marketing agency and you'd like to find out what your peers are up to and what's working in the industry, get access to the Bright Ideas 2013 Marketing Agency Industry Report by going to brightideas.co/2013report. As well, if you're looking for traffic generation strategies for you or your clients' websites, go to brightideas.co/massive-traffic and enter your email address. And when you do, you'll be given free access to the Massive Traffic Toolkit, which is a compilation of all of the best traffic generation ideas that have been shared with me by many of the guests here on Bright Ideas. That's it for this episode. I am your host, Trent Dearsmith. If you enjoyed this episode, please do me a favor, head on over to iTunes. There's a link at the bottom of the post that'll take you there. And leave the show a 5-star rating along with some comments in the form of feedback. Every time you do, it helps the show get more exposure in iTunes, and therefore we can help get more entrepreneurs exposed to more bright ideas to help them massively boost their business. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode. We'll see you again in another one soon. Take care.
Thanks very much for listening to the Bright Ideas Podcast. Check us out on the web at brightideas.co.
All right, show's over. I'm tired.